side two of tape number 399, July 27th, 1979. I want to share with you just a quick rundown of one character that is involved in the Doubles book to show you why I think it's so important to get into who we're just talking about when we're talking about Lee Harvey Oswald. This gentleman's name, as I mentioned before, is Curtis Laverne Crawford, and he's described, his testimony is in Volume 12 of the Warren Commission hearings. The testimony of this gentleman was taken April the 8th, 1963, but 1 month before his testimony was taken, there was a memo from Mr. Griffin, Bert W. Griffin, a legal assistant for the Warren Commission, that he sent to Leon Hubert, who also was in the room taking testimony a month later. Griffin and Hubert sent a memo dated March the 10th, 1964, that they should examine Curtis Laverne Crawford, who worked for Jack Ruby, because, in quotes, he closely resembled Lee Harvey Oswald. I think it's interesting that the Warren Commission had an employee working for Jack Ruby that resembled Oswald because some people had said that Lee Harvey Oswald was seen in the club of Jack Ruby. But yet this man lived there and did odd jobs and also could be dressed working around there in the evening or sitting at a table and be mistaken for Lee Harvey Oswald. Well, Larry Crawford was called, and I just want to give you a real quick essence of his testimony about his background to show you the kind of character that could have been the Oswald that was in the club with Jack Ruby and certainly has very suspicious background going back to his total life story, which I think is very interesting, that he should just end up at that particular time in history at the club of Jack Ruby, who's to kill Lee Harvey Oswald, and then Crawford left the next day and went on up to Michigan, and only by a fluke was the FBI able to find him because a letter addressed to him from his sister in Michigan was still in the club among some possessions after Lee Harvey Oswald was killed, and they went right up there and were able to find him. Larry Crawford was, at the time he was interviewed, was unemployed. He described one brother. He has a brother who's in the Army. This is in 1964, in Los Angeles in the Missile Corps, working in anti-aircraft. He himself enlisted in the U.S. Army September 1858 in anti-aircraft and was at Fort Ord, California. He was discharged in November 1959, 3 months, 13 months after his enlistment, and they asked for his forms, his Defense Department DD-214 Form 14, because he enlisted for 3 to 4 years. He was in 13 months and got an honorable discharge. If you read Philip Agee's book, Inside the Company, they said that many CIA people were given a military service and sent to an Army base as a cover, and then put in the CIA, so that Curtis Laverne Crawford was actually in the military, signed up for a long enlistment, and has discharge papers and was out within 13 months. When he left Fort Ord, he went to the Presidio U.S. Air Defense School up in San Francisco. Of course, Lee Harvey Oswald was working in anti-aircraft also in Marines down at El Toro about this time in 1958. He came home from Japan. And then Crawford went to Germany, and he was over there in April 59. He was transferred over there to D Battery, 2nd Missile Battalion, and he stayed there until November 59. Lee Harvey Oswald got out of the service in September 59 and was in France and went to England and entered Moscow by November 59, so that their lives, just coincidentally with anti-aircraft or so forth in California military, one in the Marines and one in the Army, were in California. And then Curtis Laverne Crawford is in Germany working with anti-aircraft, and he's in Europe the time Lee Harvey Oswald arrives in Le Havre, France, and then there is no place or person that sees him in England or Finland until he arrives at the Soviet Union in Moscow, is in the American Embassy in Moscow. Larry Crawford gave the members of the Warren Commission his discharge papers, and they thought that was agreed that was a really strange 13 months discharge, but didn't go into it. And then they went into his career that caused him, after his discharge from the service, to end up in the nightclub of Jack Ruby. He cut pulpwood up in the Northwest for 7 months. He was in the fruit picking industry. He said the fruit industry in California. He was in that 1 month. He then went from California up to Michigan, and then he went from Michigan to Dallas, Oregon. Dallas, Oregon. And he left Oregon in 61 and joined a carnival in California called the Royal West Golden Gate in Oroville, California, where he was for 4 weeks. Then he went down to Georgia, of course, Atlanta, Georgia, and that Watson information that he's given, he wasn't allowed to testify before the House Select Committee. They interviewed Robert Byron Watson on the assassination teams headquartered in Marietta, Georgia, and Atlanta, Georgia. And he was confident that Mark Lane and Dick Gregory and the House Select Committee would get him to testify, and he couldn't. But we have this Larry Crawford down in Georgia, where he went to another carnival, the Jerry Lepka 10-in-1 carnival, and he stayed a week. Then he went up to Detroit, Michigan. And these cities are interesting because overlapping always, Detroit, Michigan, the Ford Motor Company, Gerald Ford, and the Michigan connections, the Georgia connections, the Detroit, come out so much in this assassination, the Houston, Texas, and the Dallas connections. But just coincidentally, let's write it off coincidentally, here he's up in Detroit, Michigan, and he's with a kiddie carnival, he says, for 2 weeks, back to Dallas, Oregon, and Larry Crawford. And then he goes from the kiddie carnivals and Georgia and Michigan, the same man who was at Jack Ruby's nightclub that resembled Lee Harvey Oswald, and he ends up working for Federal Aviation, hired in Los Angeles through the Los Angeles office, but he's located in Nevada. And again, the Nevada connections to this are tremendous. But he's working for Federal Aviation out of Nevada, and he's a surveyor's assistant. There's no question about where he gets his background, where he was trained to be hired for Federal Aviation. According to all purposes, he's been nothing but managing the sword box, the ladder of swords, the fire eaters, the two-headed baby shows, the snake and the girly shows. But he seems to go from these travels from Detroit, Michigan, Georgia, up to Oregon again, Los Angeles, and then Federal Aviation, and he's in Nevada as a surveyor's assistant. Then Larry Crawford goes to Berkeley, California. But he doesn't remember that he does it. There's a profile on him that the Warren Commission has, and they remind him, were you in Berkeley, California, working for Stuart Hill? And they're specific, the address, 1052 Dwight Way in Berkeley, California. And Larry Crawford says, I don't remember. I've forgotten. I had worked for them. I don't remember it. But those were the years in 1957, 58, and 59 when Candy Jones, who also worked for the same agency as Gerald Ford in New York City, was sent to California. And she was sent to Oakland, California, which is just about 20 miles or right next to Berkeley, where her mind was raced and she was given double personalities. And the CIA was using that as a space for mind control agents and CIA agents to go out around the world. And Larry Crawford went from Federal Aviation in Nevada to Berkeley, which the commission, Warren Commission, knew about, but which his memory is gone. And they told him he worked from July to October in Federal Aviation, and then they changed the subject. And because he can't remember what he did in Berkeley at this company or what it was, his memory is gone, and the Warren Commission, of course, can't remind him of what he did out there. And from that time, Candy Jones said, you can be telephonically controlled by anybody. Once you get the injections in you and they create these double personalities, you can pick up a phone and be anywhere, as she was in Southeast Asia or with Jimmy Hoffa or being told to commit suicide down in the Bahamas. He was in Berkeley, and then he was out in Nevada. And then he goes from Berkeley, California, to Dallas, Texas, to a plating company in Dallas, Texas, where he worked for 2 or 3 weeks, then back up to a tannery in Oregon, and he worked for a Mr. J.D. Tracy, and then a poultry company in Dallas, Texas. And he meets somebody, or he wants to get in touch with a woman from Dallas, Texas, and he can't find her. So he testifies that he went to Las Vegas to try and find the woman he wanted to meet in Dallas, Texas. And that's interesting because there often is a woman in control of these men that is assigned to them. And there's a woman he wants whose family's in Dallas. He eventually marries her, but he has to go to Las Vegas to locate this woman. And then he spends some time hanging chickens on a chicken rack in Dallas, Texas. In March of 63, he's there. He goes then up to Port Angeles in Washington. This reminds me of James Earl Ray, the chronology I've done, and those of you who don't have it can get a tape of it. This multi-traveling of somebody, and he's always questioned about his money. He has $6 or $7 or $10. But this time he's at Port Angeles. That's just at the tip of Washington before you cross over to Victoria in the summer of 63 in June. We're getting closer to the Kennedy assassination. And then he goes down to California and works for a carnival. His wife, meanwhile, that he wanted to find in Dallas, that he found when he got to Las Vegas, the right connections, has left him and is moving in with his brother, who's still in the Los Angeles area in the Army missile work. Now, I don't know who in the Army, where the Army bases for Army missile work is, or whether he works for the Hughes Corporation or Aerospace or Lockheed, because Larry Crawford's brother is working in Army missile in Los Angeles, I guess at the time, even up through the assassination and when he was called as a witness. And this wife that he has now is staying with this brother who does the Army missile work. He goes to some man and raises strawberries and stays there 1 week. He goes back to Michigan to the Happy Land amusement farm for 3 weeks. And then we're warming up closer to the assassination time, where history just finds him in the club of Jack Ruby, answering all the phone calls 3 weeks prior to the assassination of John Kennedy. He goes to the Happy Land amusement park from Michigan for 3 weeks, down to Memphis, Tennessee. Of course, Memphis played a big part in the Kennedy assassination, the Albert Osborne connections. Osborne with a Lee Harvey Oswald on the bus going to Mexico, while another Oswald 100 miles south is entering Mexico, and two Oswalds are going to leave at the same time. He works at a Memphis fair where he meets a man named Leonard Wood, who owns, it's a German company who owns a form of ride made in Germany, specifically a German company, and he stays with that person. Then he goes to Dallas. Now, they ask him a question which is pertinent because he's been hitchhiking all over the country. Did you hitchhike to Dallas, Texas in the fall of 63? And he said no, that he had seen a man prior, a Mickey Corday. He called him a contact with Mickey Spillane. His name was Mickey Corday. I heard of him prior to this time. It wasn't a hitchhike to Dallas, Texas. I met him, and I went with him to the fairgrounds in Dallas, Texas from Memphis, Tennessee. He drove straight to Dallas, Texas. And when he gets to Dallas, Texas, he meets Jack Ruby. And he's very explicit that it was not by chance that he ended up in Dallas, Texas, that a particular person took him. So you have this mysterious man from the Defense Department with his 13 months in service and a discharge, honorable discharge after being enlisted, working for Federal Aviation, contacts in Nevada, Detroit, Michigan, the wife from Texas, located in Berkeley for months that he can't account for and has no memory, but they know he's been there. The exact times that Candy Jones is with this Gilbert Jensen in those Oakland offices, just miles away. He's an Oswald lookalike. The Warren Commission knew it. They never investigated the Michigan, the Nevada, the Memphis, the California, or the military connections. And he falls right into the lap of Jack Ruby, nor do they ever go into the connections of a Lee Harvey Oswald in Europe in the fall of 69, who is going from France into Moscow, and this man just coincidentally is there. So he ends up right in the lap of Jack Ruby. He meets him the third day at the Texas Fair. There's a summer fair, and he's going to meet Jack Ruby, and he's working the exhibit for this man named Craven, and the Craven Miles exhibit, and that is also the Jack Ruby exhibit. Jack is familiar with Mr. Craven and Mr. Miles, and he has his twist boards. I once did a tape on Jack Ruby and the twist boards, the dummy front, and the oil people, and the Warren Commission sending a memo that that could be a dummy front, and the links of that to Mr. Gregory and Marina Oswald. I won't repeat that. You can look on the list and get the tape on the Jack Ruby twist board. He ends up at that fair, and he meets Jack Ruby in Dallas, Texas, and he's in the nightclub for 3 weeks. His job there is very strange. He's at the Carousel Club. He sleeps there. According to his testimony, he has no salary. When he works for Jack Ruby, he has no overt salary at any time, really, except pennies, even though he has a wife and several children by now that are farmed out to various places. Another man, Andrew Armstrong, is with a strange background, but not involved in the double story, is at the Ruby Club also. I'm going into length about Larry Crawford because he was a dead ringer, look-alike of Lee Harvey Oswald, and he was in the club working for Ruby. He had no job, and also his job was to answer the telephones. It was a job without salary of a full-grown adult man staying on until November 23rd, the day after John Kennedy left, at which time he leaves. As a matter of fact, Jack Ruby told him after Kennedy was killed that same day, you better leave town. They don't explain why, but he told him to get out of town and that he should get on his way. He stayed with Jack Ruby and photographed the posters about Earl Warren and charging him with treason that were paid by the Birch Society at the time of the assassination. And he was with Ruby in the early hours of November 23rd, early morning hours, with a camera, and then he fled and got out of town. A man that was hired for Jack Ruby at the same time, Bill Del Mar was a hypnotist, and he was there, and he also knew Larry Crawford. Crawford didn't eat his meals at the club. He ate at the Eat Well Cafe. That's where Officer Tippett used to eat. That's where Helen Markham was known to eat. The witness to the Tippett killing, that's where the Lee Harvey Oswald, or the Oswald Double, which I'll delineate in the book, observed Officer Tippett having breakfast just days before the assassination. Eat Well's was a joint of Jack Ruby's and Larry Crawford, Officer Tippett, and Lee Harvey Oswald and Helen Markham. Mr. Hubert of the Warren Commission asked Larry Crawford, do you think it was an act of kindness on the part of Jack Ruby to take you in? And Crawford said, I think he was doing me a favor. Still in all, he was getting some pretty cheap work and labor. He said that 3 to 4 weeks before the assassination, they heard that Kennedy was coming to Dallas. He was working for Jack Ruby at the time, and it was just before the assassination that the proposed route was printed in the newspaper. With regards to where Larry Crawford was at the time of the assassination, he said that he was sleeping at the club that morning, that he overslept when John Kennedy came to town. Now, several parties called the club, and he was asleep. He didn't hear the phone. They asked him if it was in the next room, and he said yes. Did he usually hear it? Yes. Would he wake up if he heard it? Yes. Does he usually get up before 12:30 at noon? Usually, but he was awakened, and Jack came in around 2 to 2:30 and seemed very nervous. He didn't answer the phone. He could hear the phone. He usually answered the phone. Where was Larry Crawford? Was he asleep? There's no way to prove that he was even asleep at this time. But I think the important thing was that he could be dressed up and sitting at tables and could be an Oswald double close enough so that if people wanted to link Jack Ruby to Lee Harvey Oswald and tie in, which was done by the Birch Society and the far right wing, and the gang from Georgia that worked with General Walker and the American Opinion publications right after the assassinations, and up to this day kept calling Jack Rubenstein and Oswald the communist to make a Jewish communist link to this conspiracy. They could put someone who was a dead ringer, linked to the military, working there just 3 weeks prior to the assassination, have a sleeper like James Earl Ray, who did absolutely nothing from the time he left St. Louis, Missouri jail until he was in the rooming house behind where Martin Luther King was killed. He simply traveled, danced, took bartending lessons, and I had his nose fixed. He just did literally nothing with no money, just pennies handed out until he was strategically placed and could be the fall guy for that assassination. And it seems when Larry Crayford got out of the Army, they could test him for mind control, memory, and so forth. But a dead lookalike was right in that club. And if the lookalikes were planted as early as 1960, which I believe they were, And I think the machinery went in as soon as John Kennedy won the nomination for the Democrats to run against Richard Nixon, the selected man they wanted as president, that the contingencies were there to set up the assassination pattern syndrome and start it rolling. Right after the assassination, the next day, he got up at 11:15 in the morning, and he took off to Michigan. He didn't leave a note. He left the keys to the Jack Ruby's club with a garage man. And he met a man who had seen him at the fair, at that county fair, who picked him up. He said he didn't arrange it. He recognized me. He didn't know who his name was, but he had a list. He had a lift and a map. They consulted a map, and he knew the way to go, just as James Earl Ray knew the way to go out of St. Louis. He got to Chicago, and then he went on to Michigan. He left in a hurry, and it was only because the letter, as I say, from his sister was at the club that they were able to trace him. But tracing him is one thing. The necessity for creating, the expense of using these sleepers, such as James Earl Ray, the months, the expense of creating the doubles for them, that the government has the wasted energy, the wasted lives, the location of Crayford, looking back into his non-memory time in Berkeley. When I read this a long time ago and cross-filed this material at the Warren Commission hearings, we didn't think of Berkeley, California, and lack of memory as a place for mind control or brainwashing or one of the many places. But I go into this now because that is the reason, not that I have to defend myself or explain to anybody why I'm working on the doubles of Lee Harvey Oswald. The whole world doesn't topple down after you explain the massive overlay of the corruption. You know, termites can do just as good a job in breaking a house down as a bomb falling from the roof. The chances of dwellings collapsing or being eaten away by termites is even greater than a skylab falling on you. And I don't see any reason why, with the massive amount of work I've done that can be so heavily documented, to take as a first book a swap at every institution and every public official and every meeting they had and talk about their collusion. I prefer to do 5 or 6 books, maybe one a year, heavily documented, a slow way. It's slow, but it's sure, and it will last. And then maybe, you know, if I get this book completed and out, when you hear the word doubles or when you read the newspaper after these tragedies and you see these people giving information to the news people, maybe people will become more skeptical, more analytical. They won't trust the media for what they see, these human interest stories. Oh, I saw him at the rifle range. He was a good shooter. I saw the Carcano. It can shoot accurately at a fast speed. I heard him talking about communism. I heard him putting down the Marines. All of these people weren't talking about the 5/11, the real Oswald. They were talking about a man who was providing the media with the instant stories. And once that was set in people's minds, it was locked. It can't be unlocked. So if you don't delineate who these people are, Oswald, the 5/11, the Marines, the intelligent, educated, skilled, sophisticated, or the 5/9, the gruffy, provocateur, and the 2 or 3 or 4 people impersonating him over and over again, and the fact that the commission knew it. You see, the commission knew in March that Larry Crayford was a lookalike, and there isn't anything in their 102 pages of testimony that indicates that they did a thing about it. And I think it's a symptom of a problem, and that is why I'm taking this route. And I think you'll like the end product, and if it's solid and secure, I can build other blocks. Like you build a pyramid, you don't start at the top and look down. You have some solid blocks, and you build a base. And as far as you go along, that base is solid, and that's the way I prefer to work, and that's why I'm working on the doubles. Now to another subject. There was a meeting of the military junta right here in the Monterey Peninsula this week. former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, former NATO Commander Alexander Haig, West German Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, who recently resigned or is out of office now, Mr. Bechtel from Bechtel Corporation, and David Packard from Hewlett-Packard Company. Stephen Bechtel Jr. was the host of the gathering at the residence. They flew in to visit and socialize and do a little yachting out in the harbor, and Mr. Schmidt also wanted to visit the 10-day Bach Festival. It's been going on for 10 days. It's an annual musical festival. He was here in 1976, and he was back here to attend the Bach Festival this year. They sailed out in the harbor and talked about the 1980 Moscow Olympics, the Trans-Pacific races, and so forth. They went to hear performances by Bach, Haydn, and Mozart. East German artists were there. There was an harpsichordist and violinist from Germany, and they attended these concerts at the Carmel Bach Festival. All very innocent sports for men on vacation. Haig, Kissinger, Hewlett-Packard's director, Mr. Packard, Mr. Bechtel, and Henry Kissinger. Reminds me of the book I've quoted before, The Nazis Go Underground, by Kurt Rees. This was put out in the 40s, 1943, and it tells how the Nazis were reorganizing their plans to take over the world. It says that Himmler divided various agencies into two parts. This is when they realized that the war would have to wind down and they were losing it. They couldn't take Russia, the Soviet Union, so they would retrench for World War III. They would divide various agencies into two parts and have cell systems where the A man contacted the upper group in espionage and the B man worked with the underground. And they would give agencies different names to take the place of what they were before. The Minister of Foreign Affairs became the Culture Department. The Minister of Interior in Nazi Germany became the Department of Health. And in the Minister of Culture that was to take over, the Nazis would use this entire ministry, they said, for their underground. And it won't look like a Nazi operation. It said the propaganda ministry will have to be sacrificed. That was Goebbels' great minister of propaganda. But we'll put it under the Minister of Culture in the spirit of Goethe and Bach and Beethoven. And they must not be disturbed to re-educate the Germans. The Ministry of Culture will function as a contact between the Nazi underground and certain industrialists, and will be properly used for this purpose under the different departments of the Technical Institute and Seismology and so forth. This book on the Nazis going underground said it may seem strange that such departments should exist within the framework of the Minister of Culture, but they do. And they have precious little to do with Goethe, Bach, or Beethoven. They furnish the ideal contact between the Nazis and industry. The Minister of Culture will supervise and create a number of cultural clubs all over Germany that are excellently suited as fronts for the Nazis. And of course, we know that they're not just in Germany, and I'm very suspicious. It's nice for the old boys to get together. But when you get these names of Mr. Schultz, George Schultz, and Mr. Bechtel, Stephen Bechtel Jr., the industrialist who's building up all of Saudi Arabia. He's the man behind the contracts for all of the strong Arab nations. And people tell me or ask, why is Henry Kissinger believed by you to not be a Jew? I'm telling you, when Henry Kissinger sits with Alexander Haig and Chancellor Helmut Schmidt and Mr. Schultz and David Packard and Stephen Bechtel Jr., believe me, the Henry Kissinger there is the Nazi that went underground exactly the years that they were talking about here, and the corporate heads were meeting in Monterey and Carmel, California. Now, they're getting ready for the Reagan Kitchen Cabinet that is headquartered in Palo Alto in the Hoover Library. These will be the men behind the war, the war machine, the COINTEL operations. These are the powers, the Haig, the Kissinger, and the people whose names I've read off there. Mr. Schmidt is not a deposed person from Germany. He speaks and represents the West German government and all this activity. There's another article, Recession Map of the Effects of the Recession in the United States. In our Pacific area, it says, will not be affected this year because of the strength and diversity of its economy. And then you read the MX Missile Project in Los Angeles will provide 130,000 new jobs. California will create 46,000 new jobs from the $8.5 billion in the state's economy from this missile project. It's a tragedy that so much in California is dependent upon the missile contracts, upon these warheads, this war machine, the aerospace industry. Don't forget, Nixon was their selected candidate. Reagan is their selected candidate. And meanwhile, while you're having a nice summer vacation and we can't agree upon our strategy, I'll bet you anything, all five or six of those men, if you can call them men, sat down and agreed about everything they wanted to do. That is the tragedy. They could get together. We couldn't get six researchers to sit together, but I'll bet you on that yacht when they went out to the harbor or to the Bach Festival, they really got together on what they were going to do to us. And now we have to sit and wait or do something about it, and I guess that's up to each of us. Take care. Our time is out again. I'll be with you next week. This is Mae Breslin, Carmel.